So, let's turn to page 360-361 in our Art Scroll Chumash. And we've been talking about, so the last couple weeks we talked about Pesach-related things. So, as I mentioned last week, we kind of skipped this mitzvah just because I wanted to do Karban Pesach and Chametz connected, since it's more thematically alike. But here we have the same thing. Here we have the mitzvah of Pidyon HaBen. So let's just read the first Yipsukim of Perik Yud Gimel of the 13th chapter. Vayidaber Adonai al Moshe l'mor, Kadesh li kol bechor, Peter kol rechem b'vnei Yisrael ba'adam, Uva behima lihu. In English, Hashem spoke to Moses, saying, sanctify to me every firstborn, the first issue of every womb among the children of Israel, of man and beast, is mine. Okay, so how would you characterize what's going on here?
So Hashem is telling Moses to basically sanctify in his name the firstborn, the first produce, I guess. I don't know.
Produce, right? The fruits of the loins.
The fruits of the loins.
Right.
Sounds better than issue, which is like a magazine. Of any man or beast. So basically, to bless any firstborn.
Okay, so it's they're blessed and they're mine, right? Mm-hmm. So we're not going to talk as much about the animals as about it's man and beast. So we'll focus more on the man than the beast. So, man and beast is mine. What does that mean? What does that mean, they're mine, as opposed to what? Aren't we all God's children? Aren't we all... I mean, what does that mean that this one is mine?
I think it means subordination, obedience.
But in what way is that different than... I don't know. We all have our commandments. The Jewish people have their 613 commandments.
We don't have to follow the commandments. We don't have to...
Well, we all do. Now the firstborns are robots. I mean, how are they any different?
Right.
But I think
they are.
No. But I'm saying that's why Hashem says, "I want dedication. I want this to be mine."
Okay, but what does it mean? What does it mean to be mine? Do we do human sacrifices?
No.
Do we?
Is it related to
give a tattoo?
Firstborn of the Egyptians, because.
Okay, we'll see. It's definitely connected to the firstborn of the Egyptians. But the question is, what is God asking for here? Right? What is Hashem asking for? What does Hashem want
basically
this
to
be?
Acknowledge that any firstborn is thanks to Him.
Okay,
I guess almost like saying like this firstborn is like remembering Hashem, that Hashem made this happen.
Okay. Yeah, but again, but every child born, shouldn't we do the same thing?
Apparently not.
They were their original kohanim, right?
Okay. So what Neil's saying is, what Hashem was doing was earmarking them. What? Yeah, right? Is that they were earmarked for a specific purpose. Okay?
Yeah.
Right? That what we now see as the role of the Kohen and of the Levi, and the tribe of Levi, starts off as being the role of the firstborn, the role of being of the Bechor. Namely, that now we have a creation of a class system, right, amongst the Jewish people. And not everybody has the same responsibilities, not everyone has the same status, right? So if you look at it as the precursor to the Kohens, then it makes a little bit more sense, because if I'd ask you, if we talked about the Kohen being for God, so that we'd understand a little bit more, because the Kohen has certain restrictions and certain responsibilities. The Kohanim are the ones who are responsible for the Beit HaMikdash running, offering the Karbanot, making the whole Beit HaMikdash, the whole temple, run. And they also had certain restrictions that they were given. And they can't go to a funeral, can't come in contact with a dead body, they're limited in who they can marry, they can't marry everybody. So, if we look at it that way, so then we have a starting point.
Why have that restriction?
Why what?
Why they have that restriction?
Which restriction?
That they can't go to a cemetery they cannot marry anybody.
Yeah.
Why do they have this restriction on that?
Well, it's a higher level of Kedusha. It's a higher level of holiness. Holiness being almost being held to a higher standard, and also preventing them from being in situations that might lower their kedusha, their sensitivities as well.
So could they lose their status?
Yes, they can lose their status. Yeah, for sure. So going to a funeral, going to come in contact with the dead, is certainly in the short term is debilitating, right? And that's what this whole process. That any Jew in the times of the temple, if they would come in contact with a dead body, they'd have to go through a process of tahara, of becoming tahor.
Yeah.
Right?
Clean.
Right. And the idea is that if a person is in contact with the loss of life, they're not the same afterwards, right? They have to be resensitized to it. Because you can get desensitized to death. Ask any doctor.
But this is part of life.
No, it is part of life. It is part of life, but for some people, we don't want them to experience it too regularly, or to experience it because they have other responsibilities that it's going to steer them away from that. Yeah.
But isn't there like a group, like the people who wash the bodies, and that a week mitzvah?
No, it's a tremendous mitzvah. It's just that for the Kohen, their responsibilities, it didn't work well. I mean, the Kohen's job was to make people tahor, was to get people ready to offer the sacrifices and to be in the base of Mikdash. They were in the sanctifying business, and so just the idea is to keep them away. Look, what Yerbi is referring to is there's a mitzvah of preparing a body for a burial. I've done it once in my life. Okay,
what?
Prepared a body for burial. Hmm. And I'm sure if I did it many times, I would become desensitized to it. But I couldn't talk for 2 hours after it. And this was total stranger, just, whatever. I was actually in Binghamton, New York at my in-laws for the summer. And they needed an extra person. And I said, okay, I'll try. I mean, it definitely affects you. I mean, you can't...
Well, there's no question about it.
And to a certain extent, it's part of life, but it's not good for the Kohen to be desensitized to it. We don't want them to be too desensitized to this. We want them to be connected to life more than death. Let's put it that way for now. Although there's certainly people who it's appropriate to do that for. And marriage as well. Who they marry, it's the same thing. I mean, if you have a princess, right? Every fairy tale, right, is all about the princess and who she's going to marry. What? Right, it's the frog, now it's the beast, now it's this, now it's that, right? It's always something, right? But really, I mean, who is the princess going to marry, right? She's not going to marry the tailor's son, right? She's going to marry someone of royalty, right? Why? Because she's a princess. You don't have to explain it any more than that. There are limitations who she's going to marry, right? Beyond her control, right? And for a lot of us, that basically, we fall under certain categories like that as well. So the Kohen has a higher level of that. I mean, if we look at the Kohen as being a priest, as being, a prince to a certain extent, so there's going to be natural limitations on who they marry. That's kind of the way the Torah constructs it.
But now, is it still the case that if you are a firstborn, you're not a Kohen, like a...
No, so we'll get to how this changes. Yeah, okay. We'll get to how this changes. But right now, if we look at the framework of Hashem is sanctifying the firstborns in the same way Hashem will later sanctify the Kohen, right? But we haven't gotten to the Kohen yet, right? The Kohen hasn't distinguished themselves. First of all, there's no idea of a Kohen yet, right? There is no Kohen yet. Aaron, the first Kohen, Moshe's brother, has not been made into a Kohen yet, so we have no Kohen. Number two, the tribe of Levi has somewhat distinguished themselves, but they're going to distinguish themselves more later on in the Torah. That's going to kind of make this transfer. Okay, so here we have the sanctification of the firstborn. So the first child. Now, how does this relate to what just happened? Now, it's a little bit too coincidental that we just finished the plague of the firstborn, and now God is sanctifying the firstborn. It's a little too coincidental. What's the connection between them? The truth is, if you think about it, the concept of a firstborn goes back even earlier than this. When's the first time in the Torah we see the concept of the firstborn being a relevant status?
Sacrifice.
What sacrifice? I'm what?
Sacrifice.
No, but that
it's
was
not really
his
a firstborn,
firstborn
issue. Yeah, no. Well, it's in the parsha we're reading this week. It's Yaakov and Esav.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The whole discussion of Esav
sells
it. Right. Elin Esav sells the firstborn to Yaakov. Yaakov steals it from him. Steals the blessing for the firstborn. Right. This is for the first time. I mean, we see siblings, but like with Cain and Hevel, doesn't seem to be so relevant to who's older, who's younger. It doesn't seem to be the major issue there at all. And the other siblings, yeah, with Yitzchak and with Yishmael. Yeah, there's issues, but it doesn't seem to be because of... Yeah. But the concept of a status of the firstborn, of a uniqueness of the firstborn, is really brought up in this week's parsha that we're reading this coming week. And that becomes the major issue, right? Not only with Yaakov and Esav, but with Rachel and Leah as well. Right? Because it ends up that Lavan's major reasoning why he had to trick Yaakov into marrying Leah instead of Rachel is because he says to him, that's not the way we do things here. The older one has to get married before the younger one. And Leah is the older one, so you have to marry her first. And that logic seems to hold on some level. But here we see a real struggle, for the firstborn. It's interesting. It's something we talked about in the class today. But it's interesting that this whole struggle for the firstborn, but if you look at the beginning of the Parsha, Hashem says to Rivka, when she's pregnant with these two children, she's concerned, she feels like something is wrong. So says, two nations are in your womb, two regimes from your inside shall be separated. The might shall pass from one regime to the other, and the elder shall serve the younger. Right? Almost implying that it's better to be the younger one than the older one. Right? The elder one's going to be serving the older one. And it ends up that Esav is born as the elder one, Yaakov is the younger one.
And it flips.
Right. And yet, Yaakov still struggles his whole life to gain status as being the firstborn. Mm. Right? So that's the question to yourself. Why does Yaakov want this so bad if it seems to be better to be the younger one than the older one? But okay.
Because I think he was more capable of leading and he wanted something.
Yeah, I mean, so whatever. I mean, I'm not going to get into it too much now. But yeah, I mean, on some level that becomes... He obviously thinks there's a benefit. He gets something out of it. And maybe it's important for him to be the firstborn. But that's really the first time we see this even being a concept. But then again, here, when it comes to the tenth plague is the plague of the firstborn. So why does Hashem make the Jewish firstborns special? So I saw one, I believe this was the Kli Yakar, who said that Hashem had to create a justification as to why to distinguish between the Egyptian firstborns and the Jewish firstborns. Because at this point, the Jews weren't that God-fearing of a people, right? They had been in Egypt for hundreds of years. They had already been completely a part of their culture. They were slaves. They weren't educated. I mean, there wasn't much to write home about at this point. And it was very hard to distinguish between the Egyptian and Jewish firstborns. So the way he understands it is that Hashem almost artificially creates a status for the Jewish firstborns to justify why he should distinguish between the Jewish firstborn and the Egyptian firstborn. That's an interesting perspective.
But also there's an interesting thing where the Egyptians were killing all of the Jewish firstborns.
They're killing all the Jewish males.
Male
firstborns. Not just firstborns, but all the Jewish boys. So
that's also like, I guess, I don't know, maybe that has something to do with it, like in a way, because so many were killed now.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the Mida.
Like
that's yeah. Well, that's the Mida Kenegan Mida. That's why it makes sense for them to punish the Jewish firstborns more than the others. I'm saying that why it makes sense to punish the Egyptians and kill their boys when, yeah. But the concept of the firstborn, that's not really part of that. So now we're kind of introduced this concept of the Bechor, of the firstborn. So the firstborn, what's their role? Why are they unique? Okay. And then what happens to them? So let's first describe a little bit why this changes, and then to get into the mitzvah that we have today. So right now we have the sanctification of the firstborn. That all changes after the sin of the golden calf. Okay? So if you go to... Perek Lamed Gimel. I'm sorry, Lamed Bet. Turn to page 501. So at the top of page 501, this is Perek Lamed Gimel 32, Pasuk 26, Chavav. It says, "Vayamod Moshe b'shar machaneh v'yomer mi l'Hashem ilai, v'yasfu elav kol b'nei Levi." Moses stood at the gateway of the camp and said, "Whoever is for Hashem, join me." And all the Levites gathered around him. And he said to them, "So said Hashem, the God of Israel, every man put a sword on his thigh and pass back and forth from gate to gate in the camp. Let every man kill his brother, every man his fellow, and every man is near one." Levites did as Moshe said. About 3,000 men of the people fell that day. Moshe said, "Dedicate yourselves this day to Hashem, for each has opposed his son and brother, that he may bestow upon you a blessing this day." So here we have the changing of the guard. That 11 tribes participate in the sin of the golden calf. The one tribe that does not participate is the tribe of Levi. Right, and the tribe of Levi distinguishes itself. They distinguish themselves when they're in Egypt, and they distinguish themselves again here. That while all the rest of the people kind of get wrapped up and excited in, you know, the fervor of the sin of the golden calf, they refrain, right? And Aaron is from the tribe of Levi, and Moses, their brothers, they're both from the tribe of Levi. And Aaron ends up symbolizing, you know, the one who's, well, in some ways he's trying to fight against it, in some ways trying to appease them. But the tribe of Levi is the one who stands up. So now we have the changing of the guard. Because now the tribe of Levi is given the responsibility of meting out justice to those who caused this sin. And it ends up that 3,000 people are killed. So now the firstborns have lost their rights. Right, they were supposed to be sanctified. They're supposed to be made holy. They're supposed to be this upper class, and then they lose that right here to the tribe of Levi, and then that's so now it's transferred over later in the Torah. It's formally transferred to the tribe of Levi and to eventually the Kohen, which becomes a subset of the tribe of Levi. Right, so that's how we end up getting to where we are today. So if you turn ahead to page 835 in Parsha Korach. This is the 18th chapter, Yud Chet. So if you look at 15, Tedvav, Kol Petzer Rechem Lekol Basar Sheyakrivu Ladonai Ba'adam uva behima, yelach, ach pado tifte et bechor hadam, et bechor behima hatmea tifte, ubetuyav mi ben chodesh tifte bearkecha, kesef chamesh kalim beshekel kodesh, esrim geira hu. English, every firstborn of a womb of any flesh that they offer to Hashem, whether man or beast, shall be yours. But you shall surely redeem the firstborn of man, and the firstborn of an impure beast shall you redeem. Those that are to be redeemed from 1 month shall you redeem according to the valuation. 5 silver shekels by the sacred shekel, it is 20 gerah. So here now we have the next stage of the process, the concept of redemption. So now we have this transfer of power, right? From the bechor, from the firstborn to the kohen. So does the firstborn completely lose its status? Well, yes and no. It seems that the Bechor is supposed to be subservient to the Kohen, right? to such an extent that they are given over to the Kohen. Right? The Kohen, by right, the Kohen should take possession of the firstborn son. Okay? And through this process of redemption, then the child can remain with their family. Right? And that is basically, at its core, that's the mitzvah that we have today, of Pidyon HaBen. Right? If you've ever been to a Pidyon HaBen, that is the redemption of the firstborn son. And what you have here, you have a child.
Oh, what is they talking about?
So you're selling.
So that's what we have. We have five silver coins, five silver
shekels. So you're selling the kid?
You're buying back the kid. By right, it's the Kohen's kid, and you're paying the Kohen to
give back the kid.
Yeah, to get it right.
It's God's kid, not really the Kohen, no?
Well, it starts off as being God's, right? But then the Bechor loses its status as God's special group.
And then the gold comes in, because they usually put gold.
Yeah, so that's a more modern custom. That's not part of the Torah's description of the mitzvah. Yeah, but that ends up being how we... that women put the jewelry on the plate where the baby is held. Yeah, that's all part of the of the fanfare. Yeah, that's a more modern thing. Okay. So it's now it's the coins. What?
Good, cute ceremony. I didn't like the gold part, but
it's a cute ceremony.
Yeah. I like the kid on the silver plate. The
kid, yeah, it's very elaborate. It's a very I tried to do the math on this. What percentage of babies are eligible for Pidyon HaBen? So these are the factors that go into it. We'll discuss these factors. Number one, can't be a child of a Kohen or a Levi because they're already in the status of being a Kohen or a Levi. So they're not bought back. They're already in that special group. If the mother grew up as a Kohen or a Levi, she's a, you know, so if her father was a Kohen or a Levi, same thing. Okay, so then also they're eligible. She's already from that tribe. Next stage is it has to be the firstborn son. Okay? So it has to be the
Why son?
So we'll get into son. We'll get into that. But that goes back to the original. Originally, this status was given to the males, just like the status of a Kohen is really given to the males.
At the beginning, it said just firstborn. Only here does it say firstborn of man. Well, I don't know. It could be interpreted.
That would prejudice those things.
They could have.
But it said firstborn. Yeah. It didn't say... whether it was male or female.
If you go back, I mean, all the way back to the parsha we're discussing in the beginning.
360. It says, sanctify to me every firstborn, the first issue of every womb, among the children of Israel, of man
been,
and
beast. Adam of Behemah, is there any clear...
could be that since it's connected to the Kohen, and we know that the Kohen, all
the lineage.
Well, and also remember, it's also connected to the slaying of the firstborns,
which
also male. Right. I mean, the status almost always went on the man.
In Egypt, it was male and female, wasn't it?
Not the kills that were killed. That was male. Yeah, I think it follows the same rules. So here too, status would go by the men, and the wife would join her husband's status, whatever. I mean, the tribes would follow the husband, just because it's impractical to have both of them, right? It's like last names, right?
Who do you pick?
You have to pick, right? So, can't pick both last names. I mean, you can, but
one always goes first.
That has to end eventually, because I always joke that if this one has two last names and that one has two last names, what happens when the kids get married and they have four last names? Now what happens when their kids get married? Now you got up to eight last names. Like pretty soon. You know, it's Schwartz, Feigenbaum, Goldstein, Cohen. okay, you got, it stops at a certain point. You can't do this forever. It's cute for one generation to do it, but
go to Spain, they have eight names.
Yeah,
but it's not sustainable at some point.
Well, what? It's not sustainable at a certain point. It's right. It just goes on forever. So status follows the men. Because you have to pick when picking the family, that you have to follow somebody.
I know, actually, an observant Orthodox family in San Francisco, they named one child, a girl, after mother's maiden name, and the son in the family, the father's name.
Yeah, I mean, people do.
I thought they'd say it's not allowed.
Not allowed what? In American law or Jewish law?
No. Name the same name who still lives.
No, the last that, name. The last name.
That's not the first.
Meaning if the mother's name was Cohen and the father's name was Schwartz, so the girls became Cohens and the boys became Schwartzes. Yeah, people, you know.
So
people are creative.
So going back to the Peyuna Ben, one of the rules also is that it has to be a natural birth, right?
Right, so it has to be a natural birth. It has to be the firstborn.
And why does it have to be a natural
birth?
Okay,
so we'll talk about that. And also it has to be the firstborn child, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it has to have been, and there can't there cannot have been a miscarriage at a point when it was a fetus. Okay, so basically you're talking about firstborn son, so now you're 50% already, mm-hmm. right? Can't be a Kohen or a Levi, or the wife can't be from a Kohen or a Levi. Let's say that knocks out another 10%, right? Can't have been a miscarriage. I don't know what's that. How many women have miscarriages? Another 5 to 10%. I don't know.
That sounds high.
That sounds high. Maybe
let's say 5%.
I think it is common.
5%. Yeah, I mean it's
what's considered enough. A miscarriage that's not a fetus like before.
Usually at least 2 months. At least 2 months. Yeah, at least two months.
That's all.
But you said
that's two or three
only
months.
Only male offspring. That's already 50%. But
right.
Is it true that it's 50-50, 50 female and 50 male?
Well,
48.
I mean,
yeah. 48-52.
Well, yeah, I mean, roughly 50-50, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Roughly
it's 50. Like head and tails.
Yeah, is that the case, actually?
For the most part, I mean, 51-49, I guess. I don't know. Well, I mean, it's not exactly 50%. That's impossible.
No, but I didn't think it was even close.
What, you think there's more of what?
More women.
More girls born than boys?
Yeah. I thought so.
It's like head or tails.
Yeah, I don't think it's a big difference.
What about like firstborn versus what if that is?
Oh, I don't know.
30%?
I don't see why that would be any different. Your odds are the same.
Depends how many children the family has.
I'm saying the firstborn.
I'm saying all the kids.
The firstborn child is going to still be 50-50. He's a boy or a girl.
I think it is probably very small. Some of them have 8 to 10 kids, so only one kid is the firstborn.
Well, even people with two kids, only one kid's the firstborn.
Well, what if there's twins? one of them always comes out first.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Like my brother and sister are twins. They are older than me. My sister is a half an hour older.
Half an hour is a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, if you do the math, I figure maybe 20% of cases. Like 15 to 20, right? And it has to be natural born. It can't be a C-section, can't be cesarean.
And why?
You're probably talking 15 to 20%.
Yeah.
Of firstborns can you have a Peyuna Ben? So between one in four and one in five firstborns does this apply? That's probably okay. So we'll get into the reasons for this. Okay. So a few main questions to answer. So number one. So we talked about why we have the sanctification of the firstborn. The big question is, why does this status remain on some level, right? Why do we continue to have this mitzvah? Why don't we just have a full transfer of power from the Bechor to the tribe of Levi, right? Why does Hashem still want us to get involved in this process, right? Just okay. So the Bechor lost their right to be this group. So fine. So let's move on. Let's move on and now it's the Levi. But this procedure, right, this mitzvah still keeps the status of the Bechor relevant. I mean, beyond just their family, but kind of on a global scale. So, a few things to think about. So, one reason could be, that's the point, right? Now, definitely some commentaries point out that Hashem can't just remove their status. They're already given the status as a Bechor. So Hashem can't just remove it, can only minimize it. So they still have this status, and the Bechor therefore has to be, you know, bought back, because they really should be subservient to the Kohen. They should still be Kadosh, they still should be sanctified and have this special role. But Hashem also doesn't really, you know, it's now given over to the Kohen. So Hashem wants us to remember that they lost it, right? So it's almost it's a reminder that the Kohen had this, the Bechor had this possibility. Could, you know, I could have been something, I could have been somebody, and your status was lost because so many years ago, the firstborns participated in the sin of the golden calf. Instead of them stepping up as being leaders, they ended up just following the crowd. So they should, they're not ready, you know, this isn't for them. But the tribe of Levi, they were able to step up. Yeah.
But they didn't distinguish themselves.
They didn't not distinguish themselves. I mean, the role here is going to be a role model for the rest of the Jewish people, to teach them, right? And to stand up for the things that need to be, you know, when you need to stand up. And the key moment when they need to do that, they don't. And the tribe of Levi, who's not given any extra responsibility or any extra level, they stood up and they became that role. You know, ends up kind of being, you know, the Maccabees or Kohanim, right? It's not same kind of role. They end up standing up when the rest of society is ready to back down to the Greeks, and they stand up and fight.
So when are the when the Levies are kind of distinguished as a group, but when are the Kohanis?
So that happens. With Aaron. Aaron in the Torah is given special status in his sons.
So then it's only his lineage, only Aaron's lineage.
Right, a Kohen by definition means they're from the lineage of Aaron. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. From the lineage of Aaron. So that's part of it. So part of it is just remembering, realizing that that status was lost. But I think there's an important lesson here that should be remembered, you know, when you have a Pidyon HaBet, is that people should realize how one mistake can completely change your entire life, right? I think that's an important lesson from that story, is that the Bechor was this status, and not only did their actions affect their lives, it affected future generations as well, right? And life really is that way. You know, life can really be that way. One mistake can destroy, or one episode, one incident, one second, can completely change not only your life, but future generations as well. I was this week I was really into JFK assassination stuff. I don't know. I'm kind of really interested. You know, I was watching this whole documentary this week about the Warren Commission. You know, the Warren Commission, right? The group of people that were in charge of
investigating
it. It's really interesting. You know, and it's, you know, it was basically a joke of a commission. I mean, you had 9 people in this commission, including the Chief Justice and one future president. You know, one future president was on the 9-man commission to investigate what happened. Gerald Ford is one of the 9 people. But of course, none of them really did any of the work because, you know, that's the way it is. They hired a bunch of attorneys, ages 28-32. To do all the work, right? And they did all the legwork, and they did all the investigating, and they did all the research. And then every time they tried to really look into something that was confidential, the CIA denied them access, the FBI denied them access, so they couldn't even do the job. And it ends up that the theory that's proposed, the magic bullet theory, the single bullet theory, that one bullet went through Kennedy's back, through his neck, and then hit Governor Connally, who was in front of him. So that theory ends up being proposed by a current U.S. senator, who at the time was a 31-year-old Philadelphia lawyer. His name's Arlen Specter. You've probably heard in the news. He just jumped back and forth between parties. So anyways, it's interesting to see the players then and kind of, you know, where some of them end up. But the JFK assassination, I think, is the best example of a moment in time that completely changes history. I mean, in so many different ways. So many things are different if that episode doesn't happen, right? If they have a bubble top on or whatever it was, you know, he could have been assassinated a different time or a different place. But a moment in time when something just changes everything. Now, sometimes we think certain things change everything. They really don't. But sometimes things really just change, you know, so many things, you know, life gets changed because of it. I think that's part of the lesson of the Pidyon HaBet, is that a single moment in time or a single mistake can ruin you forever, can affect you forever, right? And there's not a whole lot of going back necessarily, right? There's some things you can correct and some things you can't. And you have to always be aware of that, right? So the Pidyon HaBen, I think, you know, in some ways reminds us of the sins of the Bechor, the sins of the firstborn, and teaches us that lesson. So first of all, why the firstborn child? And let's talk about the cesarean as well. So one answer I saw that I liked was that a child, that the parents are part of the creative process with the parents, right? And the natural process of giving birth is a partnership with God. Now, it's very easy to forget that. I mean, it's easy to know it psychologically, intellectually, but you don't really internalize that message. So the concept of the Pidyon HaBen could very well be as well reminding us that Hashem is part of this process as well. Okay? Now, some of the Sefer HaChinuch describes it that it's supposed to teach us that that we think we have possessions, we think we have things that are ours, and they're not ours. And the truth is, when it comes to children, it's especially dangerous. When people talk about their kids, it's very often put in possessive terms. Right? These are my kids. These are my grandchildren. Is that one yours? Yes, that one's mine. Oh, which one of these are yours? Oh, that one, those are mine. Right? It's a natural way of talking, right? But we speak in possessive terms, right? This one is mine, right? These are mine. Those are yours. And the concept of possessing a child doesn't really make sense, right? They're not your child. You give birth to the child. You're the parent of the child. But you don't own them, right? And any parent who, you know, once you have a teenager and once they leave the house, you realize very
that's
quickly.
Something else. But what?
That doesn't happen to Jewish
families. When animals. They are small and you have to be protected, it is under your protection.
No, so you're responsible for the child, you don't own the child. But meaning, by giving birth to the child, you are now accepting upon yourself the responsibility to raise them.
To have it.
Right.
Maybe. Yeah.
Right, but it doesn't make it yours. It just makes it your responsibility. Right? But not your possession. Right? There's a fine line. Meaning, if I ask you to house sit, and I say, look, you're responsible. If something happens, I'm going to blame you. So you're going to watch the house, right? It doesn't become yours. You're just responsible to watch and to take care of it.
What if you buy the house?
If you buy the house...
In this case, you're almost like buying the kid.
Well, you don't buy... But that's the point. The point is, we're prone to look at it that way and feel that way. That we own the kid. But we don't own the kid. We know we don't own the kid. And in the end, the kid owns us much more than the parents own the kid. Right?
And ultimately, Hashem owns all of us.
Right. And ultimately, the parent just has a role here. Right? The parent has a role, a responsibility to raise the child. And it's very important for the parent to look at it that way. Because if the parent looks at themselves as possessing the child, then their expectations for the child are going to go up. The importance that the child does what they want or follows their wishes becomes a lot more important, right? If you look at the child as being your responsibility, right, in your trust, then you're able to remove yourself slightly from the situation and really objectively ask yourself moment to moment what's best for this child, right? My job, my responsibility to do what's best for this child, not what's best for me. And sometimes those two things will be the same, and sometimes they won't be. But when it's about the parents possessing the child, then, you know, look, you know, by definition, a parent feels, a sense of pride and ego from the child, you know? Someone says to me, you know, your child is cute, or your child is smart, right? The message I get is not, oh, that person that little kid who
you have to be in care of.
Right, you happen to be in care of. Boy, they're smart, right? The message you get is, you have a smart child. You must be smart yourself, right? Or, wow. It becomes an extension of your own ego, extension of yourself. Just
At least you produced it.
What?
At the least, you produced it.
Right, but again, I didn't create myself, so what did I do, right? I'm not responsible for my own intelligence or whatever. I didn't do that, right? Someone else did it for me. So ultimately, I should, you know, it's really a reflection on my parents, and it's really a reflection on their parents, and really it's a reflection on them. Meaning, it's not any of us, right? We didn't do any of this, right? We're just doing what comes naturally, and whatever happens, happens. So, the Pidyon HaBen is supposed to create a sense that it's not your child. And to even go through the process of buying back the child from the Kohen is a bit jarring, but I think, you know, that's kind of the message. The message is, it's not really your child. Meaning, it's your responsibility, it's your trust, but you don't own this child. And just because you gave birth to the child doesn't mean you possess it. It's interesting, but there's a few times we see this in Tanakh, this exact thing plays out. Right? What happened? The story of Shmuel, of Samuel the prophet, and of Shimshon and of Samson. Two episodes where you had mothers who were barren, they were able to have children, and their reaction was, they gave the child to the Kohen. Right? They gave the child in trust to the Kohen, to the base of Middash, and said, we want the child to be raised here, and we want the child to grow up in the temple and become, and they almost became like part of, you know, they grew up there. That became their family. And the you know, and we don't even see the parents even being involved much anymore. So we have two stories in Tanakh, two very well-known stories, the prophet Samuel and of Samson, where that exact thing actually happens, right? It's almost, you always have these two mothers who are so thankful for their ability to have a child that they, you know, they've realized that it's not them. I mean, they've given up, they've completely submitted to Hashem, if I have a child, it's because of you, and it's not because of me. And they almost naturally react and say, okay, Hashem is your child.
But even Abraham and Isaac, that's almost like...
Yeah, exactly. It starts That's a good point, right. When he's asked to sacrifice his son, mm-hmm. right, the message is very clear, mm-hmm. it's not yours, mm-hmm. right? And I'm asking you to destroy because it's my, I created it. Right? Exactly, that's a good point. So that's a big part of this as well, is to help us reflect upon that and to remember that. Okay. I saw some good ideas here from the book called The Mitzvot by Abraham Chill. So I look at it every once in a while, but this was, it has some another interesting idea from Rabbeinu Bachya, Bachya ben Asher. And the message here was, why is the concept of the firstborn so important? Because the firstborn is supposed to symbolize the Jewish people, right? Meaning, we are God's firstborn. We are God's first son, first people, right? Now, what's going to happen? So, throughout history, we're going to have the firstborn. There will be others who claim that the firstborn has been abandoned and now somebody else is taking its place. So, the concept of sanctifying the firstborn in the beginning and keeping that alive is to show us that the firstborn is still relevant. Meaning, God sanctified us, and that we didn't. Even if we sin, we don't lose it. Right? God doesn't abandon us. Right? There is not now a New Testament and a new people. Right? The firstborn is always going to stay special. Okay, so that's what he says. So it's reminding us of that.
And that can probably also be extended to, yeah, we never lose our blessing, so to speak, but we also never lose our responsibility. Because in a way, I think a lot of me being a firstborn, I mean, not a man, but just being a firstborn, I think you just carry certain responsibilities, right. of having, you know, mm-hmm. and that never really goes away, you know, regardless of what happens.
Right, and that, it made sense to initially anoint the firstborn as being separate, because the firstborn tends to have more responsibility to view themselves as being,
they are older than those other siblings.
Right, so they almost take on a natural leadership role. Mm-hmm. For the most part, I've seen some interesting... I mean, when you don't see that, it's odd. I've seen some families where the younger sibling ends up dominating the older sibling, even at a young age. But that's few and far between. For the most part, the older sibling's able to... You know, certainly my family was that way. I mean...
My daughter is the powerhouse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
big as she is.
Yeah, your oldest daughter is very much like my oldest sister. And they kind of like... Yeah, they just kind of take... On his leadership
two,
role.
The two schmuck over there just follows her.
we're being taped here.
Have to edit that.
I might say something about you.
Yeah, no, right? All right, so...
You have to edit that now?
I don't know, I kind of liked it.
Ooh, that's on tape, too.
Okay, so it was a natural progression. Now, also as far as being part of the creative process, I think that also could be part of the reason why it has to be a natural-born child. Is that it was built in to be part of the... This myth was built in to be part of the natural process.
Well, something that I was thinking, and I don't know, this is total assumption, is that now we have C-sections, but long time ago we didn't. So, this sounds a little cruel, but really, like, in modern... Like, a long time ago, if a baby would have had to be born a C-section, they wouldn't have been born, probably. They wouldn't have survived the labor.
Well, one or the other is going to survive.
Yeah.
Meaning... But usually it meant the mother died in childbirth and tried to save the baby. That's probably what it meant.
Yeah. So it was not, like, I think the C-section is kind of maybe not so, I mean.
It's definitely a more modern phenomenon.
Yeah.
Like to have a C-section where it's not a big deal.
Not today, but I don't know how old it is, but I heard that even my mother was talking about that. So it's at least 100 years old.
That what? That
C-section.
Oh.
So.
I don't know how far back it goes.
But I was a C-section.
You were a C-section.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
But you had a little boy. Huh? You had a young boy.
But I think, like, what I was trying to say is that it's something very, like, man-made. Like, if you were in the middle of the woods and you had to have a baby and it had to be C-section, you probably, you know, wouldn't survive.
Okay, yeah, I hear what you're saying. I mean, it's not the, there's a part of the natural process that's been changed. Maybe put it that way. This is not the, I mean, it's interesting, but the way it's put it, it's called Peter Rechem, it's definitely connected to the natural process of birth.
I heard one time that even queens had to have a C-section. Just for the reason, so there won't be any other child will be mixed up. And they had to observe the birth, some nobles, to see how they take out the child from the mother.
Hmm. So that goes, how far back does that go?
I wasn't there. I don't know. That part, I don't know.
Okay. All right. Okay.